We'll be looking at the Westminster Confession of Faith, chapter 24 this morning, of marriage and divorce. As I begin this chapter of the confession, I would like to read a paragraph from our testimony. And remember that our testimony is the companion document with the confession of faith. The confession, we don't try to go back and change or alter, but we do comment or expand on the confession and our testimony. Paragraph 1 of the of our testimony says that marriage is an ordinance of God. However, to be unmarried is also an equally honorable state, and it may be the will of God for a person to remain single. Every effort should be made to submit to the direction of God in this matter, and to maintain a chaste and obedient lifestyle. Later, it says in paragraph 16 of the testimony, we deny that marriage is a more spiritual state than the single life or that it is necessary for eternal salvation. I just want to begin with that paragraph this morning so that you'll know that marriage is spoken of directly by the confession of faith, but not because it is the only state for mankind, or that it's even a higher spiritual state. We would turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and see that Paul would urge some to be married and urge some to remain in their state, depending on God's calling in their life. And while we'll be focusing on marriage both in our class and in our worship service, as I've been preaching through Genesis, you might feel the burden to say, if you're not married, then I'm not talking to you today. Well, yes, I am. The scriptural teaching about marriage and divorce is for all individuals, and you need to hear it, whatever state that you are, whatever state that God has called you into. Of marriage and divorce, then. Paragraph 1 of the confession says, marriage is to be between one man and one woman. Neither is it lawful for any man to have more than one wife, nor for any woman to have more than one husband at the same time. Last week I preached about the institution of marriage and the form that God has given marriage, and said that it is to be heterosexual, monogamous, and patriarchal. And if any of you parents reviewed with your children their notes to see if they got down, maybe you're like one child that said, hetero what? Monoga what? Patri what? And you had a good opportunity to talk about what those big words really mean. The confession focuses on two of those things, two of those forms of marriage, and the testimony augments it and hits the third that I preached about last week. Section 1 or paragraph 1 touches on that it is to be heterosexual between one man and one woman. By implication, it denies homosexual marriages or homosexual relationships. God has instituted marriage between a man and a woman, not between a man and another man or a woman and another woman. And this is part of the created order. It is God's gift to mankind. To Adam, he gave a wife, a person comparable to him, made in the image of God, and also in the likeness of man, a helper that was suitable to him. And so Eve, Adam says, is bone of Adam's bone and flesh of Adam's flesh. Genesis 1:24 says, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. So marriage is to be between a man and a woman. It is also to be monogamous. It is to be between one man and one woman, not one and many, either men to women or women to men. To put it in the negative, polygamy is forbidden. Once again, this is an aspect that springs from the created order of mankind. In fact, you'll see that as the race of men multiplies after the fall, that that many of them follow the seed of the serpent, and they deny and abuse the good gift that God has given. And it is a mark of depravity that a man would pollute the good gift of marriage by taking what it was meant to be and twisting it into homosexuality or into polygamy. Monogamy is, as I said, part of the created order, that when Adam received Eve, he said, "They shall be joined together, and they, plural, shall be one flesh, two shall be one." And I preached on this last week. I'll just briefly cover this again today, in that it's important for us to see how the New Testament treats this passage. One important passage comes from Paul, where he quotes this in 1 Corinthians, describing the intimate bond that results even in prostitution, that two become one, two flesh become one. An even more important passage comes from Matthew 19, where Jesus quotes from Genesis 2, and he confirms that the created order is two becoming one. And he did this in response to the liberal laws regarding divorce that the Israelites were using to make and break covenants with little or no reason. He quotes from Genesis chapter 2, and he says, "Have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female? And he said, 'For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh.' So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore what God joined together, let no man separate." And they said to him, I'll read that a little bit later when we come to divorce. Now, the created order is monogamy. Section 2 of the confession touches on the purpose of marriage. Marriage was ordained for the mutual help of husband and wife, for the increase of man with a legitimate issue, and of the church with a holy seed, and for the preventing of uncleanness. The confession gives a fourfold purpose for marriage. It is first of all for mutual help. Genesis 2 is the passage we would turn to see that God created a helper suitable to him. The husband and wife are to serve each other, says Ephesians chapter 5. And to serve each other in mutual help. They serve each other in different ways, and thus we have the roles that are given to husbands and wives. They are given for mutual help. Second, they are given for procreation. Genesis chapter 2 again. God had given a mandate to mankind to fill and subdue the earth, to have dominion over it. And there were only two, Adam and Eve. How is this to take place? Well, God gave them the gift of having children so that they could fulfill their mandate. This is one aspect of the purpose of marriage, and one aspect for our understanding the purpose for the sexual union. It's not the only aspect or purpose. Roland Ward, in his commentary on the confession, says that the Church of Rome tends to stress procreation as the fundamental purpose of marriage, whereas the Protestant position is that it is only one of the purposes, and then not necessarily the primary one. However, one should not be too ready to wish to prevent the birth of children, since children are to be regarded as a blessing from the Lord. It's appropriate for me at this point to comment on the approach towards having children, and especially towards the development of contraception. And we have to bluntly say that many forms of contraception are out and out sinful because of the life of the child, which is conceived, being precious in God's eyes. Seeing procreation as one of the several forms or several purposes of marriage, would instruct us to believe that contraception is an allowable thing. And we would turn to even 2 Corinthians 7, where there is a withholding of yourself from your spouse for a time. Nevertheless, even allowable forms of contraception can be sinful when they are practiced for sinful reasons. And in our culture today, where children are viewed as a burden, as unnecessary, as cramping on the lifestyle, then these are times when the practice of contraception can be viewed as sinful. Just to give an example, think of a family. And maybe you even know a family that a husband and wife decide together that the wife's career is just taking off, and this would not be a time when they should have children, and it just goes for the rest of their lives. And maybe you even know couples that they say, "Oh, I'm just not cut out to be a parent," and have chosen not to have any children at all. And we'd have to comment and say that is going against one of the great and grand purposes that God has given for marriage and for the sexual union. To augment that, or to maybe even help you see how weighty this is, one of the purposes is that there would be a holy seed for the church. One of the purposes that God has given for having children is that His kingdom would be populated. And this comes from a covenantal view of children that says that God delights to raise up members for His kingdom, members for His church, through the covenantal seed. It doesn't guarantee that our children are going to be Christians. It does guarantee that God has said, "I will be your God, and you will be my people." And that this promise is for you and for your children after you. The covenantal view says that God has purpose to work through families. That God has purpose to work through believing parents to raise believing children. Those that would be from generation to generation, those that would call upon His name. And God is a covenant-making and covenant-keeping God. His promise is to be a God to us and to our children after us. And God has not forsaken the institution of the family. This is part of the created order of what God has given for us. He takes pleasure in working through the means of godly parents to raise godly children. And that reasons 2 and 3, or purposes 2 and 3, the issue of legitimate children and providing the church with a holy seed are coupled together, and you can see the beauty of having children in the covenant home. The final purpose is because of sin, the preservation of purity. God gives a practical solution to sexual temptation. And I've quoted this before, I'll quote it again. Douglas Wilson says that God helps Christians who struggle with sexual temptation by providing sexual activity, the proper sexual activity, within the bounds of marriage. And so Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7, "Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband." Those first two paragraphs are paragraphs that touch on the form and the purpose of marriage, and I've elaborated on those in our sermons the last 2 weeks. I'll pause briefly for comments or questions. Brian?
When would contraception, God-fearing family, ever be appropriate?
Douglas Wilson has a well put example. I gave you the example of a family that says, you know, we have our careers, we don't want to sacrifice those careers so that because if the wife had a child, then she wouldn't be able to work and her career would be ruined. On the other hand, he gives the example of a family that has had four children in 4 years, and the family is the mother is tired, the wife is weary, and rightfully so. Raising children is a full time job, and he describes the planning of when you might have children, so as even to maximize the number that you would have. And the using of contraception, or the planning of or the spacing of children, so that the energy and effectiveness of your family can be maximized. That's the example that Wilson gives, and I think there's some wisdom in that. Dan,
I'm reading through the Minor Prophets, and there's a passage in Malachi that basically speaks to this. I might just read.
Please.
This is God's reason for his curse upon them. He's not receiving their offerings. Yet you say, for what reason? Because the Lord has been witness between you and the wife of your youth, with whom you have dealt treacherously. Yet she is your companion and your wife by covenant. But did he not make them one, having a remnant of the Spirit? And why one? He seeks godly offspring. Therefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously with the wife of his youth. But now that sort of hits, summarizes the whole,
yeah,
whole thing.
Thank you. Those are excellent verses to describe the offspring and godly offspring that God seeks, the covenant God.
My question is, believe God, when you're that fertilization takes place, God's finger is there at that time to create that specific person. And I know it's a balance between, everything you need to let God has given you, but if the creation of a human being is an act of God, I have a great deal of difficulty in when do I step in and take those actions to prevent. Prevent the child being born, and just trusting to God that we're not going to use contraception, and God will produce the seed that He wants to produce.
There's always a balance in life, and in seeing that God is sovereign in all that we do. God is sovereign in every aspect of life, and seeing as well the responsibility and the means that God has given to us, and using those in a God-fearing fashion. What Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7 is that this would be be something that there's a time for withholding even sexual relations from a husband and wife. But that has to be in mutual agreement between the two of you. And maybe that's where I might wisely leave it for our class today, is to leave it between you and your spouse to find the way to express your conviction that God has given a holy seed, and to seek those and promote that and to seek these purposes in marriage. I'd be real happy to pursue this a little bit further later. I think I'd like to press on and get to the issues of divorce and remarriage. Let me go on with sections 3 and 4. In the confession, it talks about lawful marriages. And let me read sections 3 and 4 of the confession. It is lawful for all sorts of people to marry, who are able with judgment to give their consent. Yet is it the duty of Christians to marry only in the Lord, and therefore such as profess the true Reformed religion should not marry with infidels, papists, or other idolaters. Neither should such as are godly be unequally yoked by marrying with such as are notoriously wicked in their life or maintaining damnable heresies. Paragraph 4, marriage ought not to be within the degrees of consanguinity or affinity forbidden in the Word, nor can such incestuous marriages ever be made lawful by any law of man or consent of parties, so as those persons may live together as man and wife. The man may not marry any of his wife's kindred nearer in blood than he may of his own, nor the woman of her husband's kindred nearer in blood than her own. First, I want you to notice that the Bible and the Confession does not prohibit marriage other than this background here, or what's summarized in these sections. That means that marriages between persons who are elderly, marriage between persons who have disabilities, who are of different nationalities or races, are all lawful and are part of God's good blessing. The general rule is that there must be mutual consent. Marriage is voluntary in that no woman is required to marry just because she is asked. And I said last week that you might take the idea of the headship of men in marriage, or headship of the husband in marriage, to the wrong conclusion, to say that men are dominant over women everywhere, at all times, and in every case. I read a quote from Dr. Boyce last week that says that nothing in Genesis implies that every woman is to exist for every man, still less be obedient to him. Moreover, even in the case of marriage, the submission involved is voluntary. No woman is obliged to accept a marriage proposal. If she does, that marriage is to follow the model of Christ in the church. But a man cannot command a woman to marry him just because he is a man and she's a woman, and therefore must obey him. God does forbid the marriage of a believer and unbeliever. Such a marriage would be binding should it take place, but the command is not to be unequally yoked together. Mixed marriages between believer and unbeliever also might arise after a marriage has taken place and one spouse is converted by God's grace. In this case, certain instructions from Paul will come to bear on divorce and remarriage, and I'll leave it until that time. Third, there are some natural restrictions that arise from blood or family relationships. In Leviticus chapter 18, there are laws which describe the laws of consanguinity, the laws that describe what relations we can have, or where we can marry. You're not allowed to marry anyone closer than a first cousin, whether by blood or by marriage. This is detailed in the Mosaic Law, but it rests on the moral law. And I say that because in Deuteronomy 18, it's very important for you to see that, Leviticus 18, that that God judges the nations around precisely because of their immorality in this area. In chapter 18, he has described what the allowable relationships are. And then in chapter Leviticus 18, starting with verse 24, he summarizes it by saying, "Do not defile yourself with any of these things, for by all these things the nations are defiled, which I am casting out before you. For the land is defiled, Therefore, I visit the punishment of its iniquity upon it, and the land vomits out its inhabitants. You shall therefore keep my statutes and judgments, and shall not commit any of these abominations, either any of you, any of your own nation, or any stranger who dwells among you. For all these abominations the men of the land have done who are before you, and thus the land is defiled. Let the land vomit you out also when you defile it, as it vomited out the nations that were before you. For whoever commits any of these abominations, the person who commits them shall be cut off from their people. The question is, how is it an abomination? The Mosaic Law had not been issued up to this point. It's an abomination because it's part of that natural law understood in a confession form. We don't believe in law that just comes out willy-nilly by observing nature, except as what we know about God because of natural law. God said that He wrote His law on man's heart, and He was judging the Canaanites because of their violation of that law that was written on their heart. And their violation was this sexual immorality, gross sexual immorality that led them into these forms of marriage that were disallowed, into bestiality and homosexuality, matters that are described there in Leviticus. They're vomited out of the land because of that. I have the pleasure of pointing out another aspect of our testimony where there is a difference of opinion that says in paragraph 20 we reject the last sentence in paragraph 4 of the Confession of Faith. In 21, the prohibition of marriage with a deceased wife's sister or a deceased husband's brother is not warranted by Scripture. The passages that are cited, or the background for that is trying to come to grips with the Levirate law. To be a kinsman redeemer was to go to your sister if she was not able to have children, and to provide a holy seed, or not sister, but your brother's wife, and to have a holy seed for that family. That law would suggest that the union is not invalid per se, but forbidden it as a rule and only allowed in special cases. And that's as I've tried to find some of the background on the rejection of that. I think that's the discussion that led to the setting aside of the comment against a man marrying his wife's kindred nearer in blood than his own. I would like to go on and talk about divorce and remarriage, and we'll take questions or comments on all these last four sections then. Section 5 says, adultery or fornication committed after a contract, being detected before marriage, gives just occasion to the innocent party to dissolve that contract. In the case of adultery after marriage, it is lawful for the innocent party to sue out a divorce, and after the divorce, to marry another, as if the offending party were dead. Although the corruption, paragraph 6, although the corruption of man may be such as is apt to study arguments unduly to put asunder those whom God has joined together in marriage, yet nothing but adultery or such willful desertion as can no way be remedied by the church or by civil magistrate is cause sufficient for dissolving the bond of marriage, wherein a public and orderly course of proceeding is to be observed, and the persons concerned in it not left to their own wills and discretion in their own case. Divorce is a serious matter. We begin with the institution of marriage and what Jesus describes in Matthew 19 is that what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. In our marriage vows, we say, until death do us part. That's the background, or the that's the one reason for the covenant bond to be dissolved in a righteous manner. God also gives, because of sin, God has also given two reasons for a marriage to be dissolved as well, because of sin. I said that divorce is a serious matter. Malachi calls it an abomination to the Lord. The question about divorce is, and especially about Jesus' words about divorce in Matthew 19, are not whether or not it is allowed, but whether Jesus repeals the Mosaic permission. I'd like you to turn to Matthew 19. We'll look at these verses together. I read the first part of this earlier about the God's or Jesus's reminder of the created order that that two become one flesh, and therefore what God has joined together, let no man separate. Verse 7, they said to him, "Why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away?" He said to them, "Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery, and whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery." In this passage, I would point out that nothing in the reason that Jesus gives suggests that he is repealing the permission for divorce, primarily because the hearts of mankind are still sinful. Jesus also goes on to say that divorce and remarriage, except for sexual immorality, that it is disallowed. He reaffirms in this wording, he reaffirms what Moses had said, and gives maybe a clearer definition to what was taking place in Deuteronomy chapter 24 and what developed historically. In Deuteronomy 24, Moses gives reason for divorce, that a husband could put his wife away because of what literally was an unclean thing. The Pharisees looked at the law of God and they said, adultery and other forms of sexual immorality were punishable by death. Premarital sexual relationships, bestiality, adultery, homosexuality. Moses, however, gave provision in the law for a certificate of divorce when something unclean was found in your wife. They concluded that this unclean thing could be virtually anything, from a lack of beauty to barrenness, just a wide gamut of reasons for putting a wife away. The important thing, they said, is to do it properly, to make sure that you dot the I's and cross the T's. Make sure you give her the document of divorce. Do it properly, and the reason can be anything, but just follow the right procedure. Jesus rejects this view in Matthew 19. He says it was not always so. The created order is that marriage is to be monogamous and to be perpetual. He rejected the liberal view of divorce, and he reiterated the permission that was given to Moses, giving sexual immorality as the only grounds for divorce. He doesn't use the word that's given for, or the Greek word that's given for adultery at this point. He uses a word that is a little broader. It's the word that we get pornography from. It's porneia. This is actually a good word for translating the unclean thing that that Moses describes in Deuteronomy 24. Go back to the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, and you'll see that Jesus showed the far-reaching and devastating effects of the ungodly divorce. He shows that those who remarry after an illegitimate divorce are actually guilty of committing adultery. The parallel passages with Matthew 19 would show that that the right of authority, the authority to prosecute is given not only to the unfaithful husband, but also to the unfaithful, to the faithful husband, but also to the faithful wife against the husband. And so, as we think about this passage and the sexual perversion and the sexual immorality that that was being confronted, Jesus confirms Moses at this point and says that there is one, there is this grounds for divorce, that of sexual immorality, defined as any illicit sexual behavior, any illicit sexual intercourse outside of the bounds of marriage. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, which we've already looked at, there are various matters that are spoken of concerning marriage. In verses 12 through 16 in this passage, a divorce between one who has become a believer and one who is not a believer is said, is, this couple is commanded not to seek a divorce. However, a believer, an unbelieving spouse who does not remain is allowed to go. This gives the grounds for the second reason that the confession cites for a lawful divorce to take place, what is sometimes called the Pauline permission, as Paul speaks about the unbelieving spouse who departs. Paul says that it is allowable for a divorce to take place, and for the church to countenance that, and for remarriage to be able to take place. Willful, deliberate desertion, therefore, is a valid ground for divorce. Some professing believers will show themselves to be worse than pagans by not caring for their extended families. How much more the one that deserts his immediate family? And the desertion of a believer from, or a professing believer from his spouse is grounds for church discipline, leading either to repentance and reconciliation or to excommunication if that should take place. If divorce takes place without these, outside of the bounds of these two exceptions. I would point out a pastoral warning that's given in section 6. It's stated in a in kind of funny ways in our, and if you think about the modern way we might say it, it says, although the corruption of man may be such as is apt to study arguments unduly to put asunder those whom God has joined together in marriage. What he's saying is that, that the heart of man is deceitfully wicked, and they will multiply reasons to have divorces. And they will, man will stay up late at night trying to find reasons to break the covenanted bond with his wife. The pastoral warning is the sinful character of man tends to look for excuses to justify sinful divorce. There are only two grounds for divorce. The covenant bond can be broken by death, of course, but by divorce only by adultery or by desertion. The Bible does not give any countenance to the separation for irreconcilable differences or for the so-called no-fault divorce. I go back to Malachi and say, these are an abomination. Divorce is an abomination. The heart of man is deceitful and will look for all manner of excuse to justify his divorce. If you're approaching marriage, I won't name any names. If you're approaching marriage, approach it seriously. It is a vow to be joined together by God, to be separated only by death. Work and maintain and strengthen the relationship, therefore, that you have for those that have covenanted together. Maintain that bond. It is till death do you part. Remarriage, simply, if the divorce is legitimate biblically, then remarriage by the innocent party is also righteous. The covenanted bond can be broken by death, and you're allowed to remarry at that point. It can be broken by adultery or by this willful desertion. If this is not the case, remarriage violates the bond of the unity made at the first marriage and is not legitimate. And I would pause and make an admission here that there are a wide variety of ways that the divorce is manifesting itself today, and the messy relationships that this has brought up. For example, what do you do if a divorcee becomes a Christian and repents of previous sin and divorce? And further, what if the spouse of the repentant one is already remarried and reconciled, is remarried to someone else? To reconcile with the first spouse would be to break the bond of this marriage. Again, I'll admit my own that this is that our lifestyle today has brought great tragedy on the situation. At some points, I look at those who come to Christ and see a new creature, what was then and what was now. On the other hand, I look at Matthew 19, which ends with Jesus' call, in the context of preaching or in limiting the liberal view of divorce that the Jews had. He says, this is what it is. And the disciples, after he said that if you do any other thing else, you commit adultery. Whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. His disciples said to him, if such is the case of man with his wife, it's better not to marry. And Jesus goes on at this point. He says, but he said to them, all cannot accept this saying, but only those to whom it has been given. For there are eunuchs who were born thus from their mother's womb, and there are eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He was able to accept it. Let him accept it. It appears that Jesus' solution is self-denial for the sake of the kingdom. Being eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom. And the disciples said, wow, that's really hard. And I'm confessing my own consternation and saying, wow, that's hard. But Jesus' words cut really to the heart of that and say that some people are born that way. Some people are given to it, made that way by men, and others have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom's sake. And the counsel for the divorcee is to give yourself to the Lord and to serve Him the rest of your life, rather than to remarry and commit adultery. And that is I give that with great tenderness, because of the good gift of marriage and because of the companionship and the blessing that it is. But it appears that all other answers would be a violation of this passage and the rest of Scripture. Once again, I've danced along the mountaintop, so I will pause and ask for questions or comments. Rob, and then Dan, and then Brian.
Well, I have three questions, but I'll limit it to one.
Okay. Three and one.
suppose your spouse is a murderer. For example, suppose a believing husband is married to a woman who aborts her child, an unbelieving woman who aborts her child. What I'm asking is murder a legitimate ground for divorce? Whereas the law would actually have her put to death. I would say, just to say it, I would say any covenant breaking sin that would be punishable by death in the Old Testament would be legitimate ground for divorce.
Let me put it a different way. That would be legitimate grounds for church discipline. That if the wife is unrepentant and unreconciled, that it's grounds, if husband or wife, whichever is the violating party, it's grounds for church discipline, and that the church has the right and responsibility to speak to that situation, to have a trial, and even excommunicate if there's no repentance. You have a case then of unequally yoked partners, that's been within the church courts that's taken place. There is the point of seeking reconciliation that I didn't pursue, but that's not really answering your question. Do you have a follow up on that?
Well, my next question is actually totally. It's one of a different subject. What's the father's role in marriage? Can he forbid his daughter from marrying a certain man? And does he have the authority to tell her that she's going to marry a man? In other words, are arranged marriages lawful, even though they would be rather unwise?
He does have the authority to forbid. And I'd have to look up. I'd have to read a little bit more on arranged marriages. Can you give me some time on that one?
Sure.
Well, the wise father would make sure that his daughter was marrying a man that the father thinks is capable of be a husband, and also recognizing because of marriage and it is a lifelong commitment. I mean, he's a pretty stupid father to marry his daughter off to, and this is his flesh and blood, to marry his daughter off to someone that might not be compatible.
I would agree. True. True. I think Rob is asking a little bit further, where the father actually chooses who the husband will be and says you will marry this person. Is that what you were saying?
I'm guessing both.
Both. Well, it's certainly within the father's right and responsibility to examine the individuals who would court his daughter and I don't know. Would he supply a list of approved candidates? That might be part of it. But the father does have the responsibility to search out or to.
It should never be more than one candidate at a time. I mean, if the daughter, yeah, I think I like that guy. I mean, it's more complex than that.
Sure.
I recommend highly the Her Hand in Marriage book. That's an excellent book to go read on that and answer that question.
I'll agree with that. Her Hand in Marriage would be a good follow up study on that question. I've got a bunch of people in the queue. Okay.
One clarifying question.
Okay.
Does this question that Rob posed imply that the young woman would be unwilling to marry a man that the father wants her to marry? There's a mutual agreement that she would be happy to marry whoever the father wants to marry. That's another question. If she doesn't want to marry whoever he says, then that's okay.
Yeah, I think that's where I need to do a little bit more reading. And I would say that in general, it's at least unwise to do that, and that a husband or that a father and daughter would be communicating, and it wouldn't be just a fiat declaration. I've got this this wonderful guy, and we've got the we're going to the chapel tomorrow, and here's your spouse. But that's not what we're talking about. I don't think that's what's being described by Brian or by Rob. That let me go ahead and pick up a couple other questions, Dan, and then Brian.
I guess my question was concerning the penal code for adultery, whether or not you would see Jesus' words as relaxing that penal code, or just dealing with the situation where the state didn't choose to enforce it.
Where the state doesn't choose to enforce it, the church does have means that is given to it. And I don't think Jesus is relaxing at this point any of the code that would be given to the state, but would be speaking more directly to what the church should do and the keys of the kingdom that they hold. And the ordinances, the inclusion or exclusion from the table of the Lord, and the ordinances of God that are given to the church, which aren't affected by whether or not the state would follow through on any prosecution of adultery. Brian?
A couple comments first. After the creation, the first institution that God is created was the marriage. So, to me, that puts marriage right up there at the top of God's priorities. Second, the woman caught in adultery and the woman at the well, both are adulteresses, and both Jesus told to go and sin no more, essentially. So, for us to say, well, my wife committed adultery or my husband committed adultery, to go and get a divorce because I'm hurt rather than to, with all my ability, try to reconcile that marriage.
Good point.
It would be a very selfish thing, and I think that would be sinful, and it would not qualify you for remarriage. The other issue is, if you knowingly, in Rob's question, marrying someone, in this particular case, a woman who is not a believer, and then has an abortion, when Paul gave the commandment not to be unequally yoked, and then he gave qualifiers, if you are unequally yoked, those people had already been married when this commandment came from Paul. We as believers, before we're married, if we knowingly marry an unbeliever thinking, oh, well, I'll change him, I think you've given up that right to a separation and not being able to remarry. That's my feeling. If you've already disobeyed God's law once, that doesn't mean, well, now I can come back under it. Just because I married the wrong person, we made that decision, and I think then it's time to, as it says here, give yourself to the Lord.
Yeah, if a marriage is covenanted, even if they are unequally yoked, it is a marriage, and falls under these guidelines. And what did I say? The corruption of man is apt to study arguments to figure out ways to get out from under God's rule and direction. I'll close with that, reinforcing what Brian has said about giving your all to reconcile. That's the testimony has some excellent passages and some excellent paragraphs that give themselves to this the heart of reconciliation, rather than divorcing, is to seek out in a godly way to bring a husband and wife back together. I've gone way over time. I'm going to dismiss this. Thank you very much for your questions.